Yes, welcome back to Tuesday's edition of World Football Daily. We are World Football Daily. We do take things global, and sometimes we take it even out of the realms of football that Raf and myself feel comfortable in on occasion. We're doing that today. We are heading into the world of Middle Eastern football. I'm delighted to welcome to the show a man making his World Football Daily debut, Mr. James Dorsey, football journalist on all things Middle Eastern football. James, how are you, mate? Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on, my man. As I say, we here at WFD aren't experts, although we like to pretend that we're experts on the world of football. Some areas do get bypassed slightly. First and foremost, in Middle Eastern football, I'm assuming this includes the area of Egypt, right?
Yes, it does. It includes all of North Africa as well as the Middle East.
So,
and it includes Iran and Turkey.
So,
and Israel, of course.
Looking at Egypt then, James, this is a side that's won, at one point, won three African Cup of Nations in a row. With the African Cup of Nations starting this weekend, why is Egypt not involved in this tournament?
Essentially, Egyptian soccer has gone through a very difficult period. In fact, for the past year, soccer has been suspended in Egypt following a politically loaded brawl in the port city of Port Said, in the Suez Canal city of Port Said, in February of last year, in which 74 fans of a Cairo club were killed. There's an ongoing trial. There's a verdict expected on the 26th of January, one day after the second overthrow of President Hosni Mubarak. And that whole situation has significantly influenced Egyptian soccer and basically led to its at least temporary deterioration.
I remember seeing that, seeing the footage of what happened in Port Said and the fans storming the pitch and flares being lobbed into the crowd, etc. You say it's stunted Egyptian football, obviously. Is there any way back for Egyptian football from this?
Well, there's definitely a way back. Keep in mind that Egypt is one of the most crowned national teams in Africa, and the two rival Cairo clubs are the most crowned clubs in Africa. No doubt they're going to bounce back. However, the issue is that in the wake of the popular revolt and the overthrow of the former dictator, there's a lot of convolution, if you wish, in Egypt. My assumption is, at this point, they've tried three times to resume the league. That has failed. They're hoping to resume it again on February 1. I would assume that that is going to fail, too. And at the core of the issue are issues that really, in a sense, are not related to football. That is to say, for the last 4 years of Mubarak's rule, the stadiums in Egypt were the front line of confrontation between opponents and opponents of the Mubarak regime and the security forces. The police and the security forces in Egypt are the most hated institution. They were the front line of the Mubarak regime's repression, not only in the stadiums, but also in the popular neighborhoods of the major Egyptian cities, in towns, in villages. And so without a reform of the police, you're not going to be able to resolve this conflict. And reform of the police is easier said than done.
James, politics in the Middle East in general is obviously a very much discussed and explosive topic in the world global community. How is it that football is seen as, is it seen as an escape from that political kind of conflict that's seemingly continually going on? Or is it seen as something that gets wrapped up and manipulated by the politics of the region?
It's all of that and more. With other words, you're talking about societies, and that's not just Egypt, in which there was, at least as long as you had an autocratic ruler, there was no public space. Now, there were all kinds of forms of dissent. Take, for example, underground music. But that really didn't pose a threat because you threw a few with musicians into prison, you stop them from entering into the country, and the problem was resolved. Nobody gave a peep. The two areas where you just couldn't do that was the mosque and the soccer pitch. Now, fact of the matter is that the world focused on the mosque, certainly post 9/11, and not on the on the soccer pitch, because soccer fans don't blow up World Trade Towers. But it was actually on the soccer pitch where things were happening. And from the perspective of the ruler, this was a threat and an opportunity. The threat was that this was an open space, large numbers of people. The institution that evoked the most deep-seated passion alongside religion, and therefore you couldn't just, you know, put everybody into prison. You had to somehow come to grips with it. The opportunity was that if you could associate yourself with something so popular as football, then maybe you could polish some of your tarnished image. You could also distract attention. And finally, in some cases, you could manipulate national emotions. And so as a result, with the emergence of militant soccer fans, you had the soccer pitch as a battlefield.
Now, James, I'm talking about the kind of politics of the region, and you say that the soccer pitch kind of became a battlefield. It still is, or not? There's been plenty of talk recently about Israel hosting the under 21 championships. What can you tell us about the reasons that are being proposed for and against for Israel hosting this this tournament? And is it likely that a protest will spark anything at all?
Let me just take one step back.
Okay.
There is no soccer or football from its introduction into the Middle East and North Africa by the Brits more than a century ago was political. There is virtually no club in the region that was not founded in some association with a political ideology or a political goal. So football is by definition political. And the soccer pitch is a battlefield, not only in terms of regime versus opponents of the regime, it's a battlefield for national, ethnic, religious identity. It's a battlefield for gender rights. It's a battlefield for social, economic rights. In the case of Israel, Israel was until somewhere, I think, in the early 1990s, if I remember correctly, a member of the Asian Football Confederation, the regional governing body that covers all of Asia as well as the Middle East in terms of football. At the behest of the Arab nations, Israel was kicked out because of the Palestinian conflict, and at that time still an Arab-Israeli conflict. And Israel wandered around for a little while and finally was incorporated into the European governing body, UEFA. So that's why you have this sort of strange situation where you have a Middle Eastern state that is playing in another region. And actually, that's to Israel's disadvantage, because Israel probably would fare much better if it were playing in Asia against playing in Europe, where it's playing against the world's foremost players and teams. And under UEFA rules, it obviously is entitled to bid and host UEFA tournaments. In this case, it's going to be hosting this year the under 21. There's a lot of opposition to that, not only from within the Middle East, but also within Europe, because of Israeli policies. And those policies go all the way from the Palestinian conflict in its entirety to a number of incidents that have happened, particularly last year, with Palestinian players. In one, particularly one case, that of Mahmoud Sarsak, who was in prison and he went on hunger strike. Now, he was accused of being a member of Islamic Jihad, which is a Gaza-based militant group opposed to the Israelis. It's been clear that he does have an association with that group. Whether he was really involved in any violence, I think, is questionable. But when you had last year a deal that was negotiated by the Egyptians, under which a mass hunger strike was ended and privileges of those prisoners were increased, he was not among those that were included in that group, and therefore he continued his hunger strike, and ultimately it was FIFA and UEFA that forced a deal that led to his release, the end of his hunger strike and his release.
It's as you say, there's so much politics joining with football that maybe does it get blurred with the fans as well? Does it become a case of like specific teams will have different ideological and political backgrounds to them and to their fans as well out in the Middle East?
Well, I think the problem is this. As I said, most clubs in the Middle East were founded with political grounds. But in some ways, that is all history. To give you an example, the two major rivals in Cairo are Al Ahly and Zamalek. Zamalek was founded as the pro-British, pro-monarchy club. Al Ahly was founded as the Republican, anti-British, anti-monarchical club. And those perceptions of one another exist until today. But fact of the matter is, the monarchy was overthrown 60 years ago. The demographic and social base of these clubs and their fan groups are essentially identical. I mean, there's no difference in them anymore. But the perception of what these clubs were politically lives on. To give you an example, a board member of Zamalek 2 years ago gave an interview in which he described his club as the King's Club. Now, this was a man who was born 15 years after the monarchy was overthrown.
Yeah, so in that sense then, how does football help break down the barriers in the political barriers, if you will, in the Middle East? Because at the moment, as I say, from what I'm hearing from you, it's all completely intertwined and it's very difficult to break away from that. I asked earlier if it was ever used as kind of an escape from that political kind of tension. Is that true as well?
Sure, it was an escape. I mean, you know, under the Mubarak regime in Egypt, for example, a run-of-the-mill husband, and the only thing you really looked forward to was the Friday game. In fact, there was for the first time ever, a study done last year by an Egyptian university at the reasons for rising divorce rates in Egypt. And the foremost reason for divorce was soccer. Because if the husband had a choice between putting a meal on the table for his family and a soccer game, it was the soccer game. If he had the choice between going on vacation with his family and going to a series of soccer games, he went to the soccer games. Wow. So the wife was either as fanatically supportive of the team or extremely tolerant, or she just said, forget this.
Wow. I mean,
now, the soccer fans, because of the fact that they were the only force over a period of years that was physically resisting the repressive machinery of the autocracy, and that's true in Egypt, it's true for other countries too, played a key role. They didn't define themselves as political. In fact, they were very careful not to define themselves as political. But they played a key role when it came to overthrowing the dictator. In the case of Egypt, they led demonstrations into Tahrir Square. They protected the square. They were basically the shock troops. And following the overthrow of Mubarak, they were the major force in the battles against the military rulers. If you look back over the last 2 years, you've had hundreds of people killed and thousands wounded in confrontations between the soccer fans and the police and the security forces. These guys are militant, They're highly politicized. They have a base that is less politicized, but that base is young men who are frustrated, uneducated, unemployed, and who have seen the police in their homes and in their neighborhoods. And this is payback time. And these guys are street battle hardened.
James, what about on the pitch itself? What's the style of football like out in the Middle East? And how is it developing? How quickly is it developing and catching up with maybe Europe?
Look, you have a number of countries that are soccer powerhouses, whether they're performing at the moment or not. Egypt is one. Saudi Arabia is another, even though it's at the moment performing very poorly. Which in 2007, at the height of the violence in Iraq, won the Asian Cup. You've got Iran, which is performing very well. So it's not that Middle Eastern soccer is underdeveloped, not doing well. It actually has a number of powerhouses, and Middle Eastern nations have made it to World Cup finals.
But it's still behind in terms of the standard, though, compared to the top European nations. I know I'm putting it on a pedestal, trying to compare it to something like, you know, Spain, Italy, Germany, etc. But how is it improving in comparison to how it was compared to Germany, again, Italy, etc.?
I'm not sure I want to frame it in those terms. I mean, obviously, football is a European sport. That's where football comes from. And indeed, some of the world's foremost teams, most of the world's foremost teams, are European. And so if we're going to talk about how you're going to meet European standards, we could say the same about Africa, Asia, or Latin America. What I'm saying is Middle Eastern, North African soccer is, by and large, very well developed. Its major handicap is politics. It's not performance or the ability to perform.
And I guess that politics is always going to be surrounding it, James.
It's going to be surrounding it for some time. I mean, we've entered into a decade of change in the Middle East and North Africa that's at times very violent. Look at Syria. That certainly is going to be convoluted, and that affects all segments of society, including football, yes.
James, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on for 15 minutes or so today and chat about this. I mean, it's an extremely deep and engrossing topic, and one that I definitely would like to chat with you again about later on in the show in the year, if you'd happily come back to World Football Daily, mate.
Be a pleasure anytime.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Tuesday's edition of World Football Daily. James Dorsey, Middle Eastern football expert, joining us here on World Football Daily to take us through an absolutely engrossing topic of Middle Eastern football and the politics that surrounds it, and of course the game itself and how politics affects it and how it's also that escape from it. And very interesting at the beginning of that, especially talking about Egypt and their kind of fall from grace with what happened last year, the two Egyptian sides having that battle between the fans and 70-odd people being killed during that, and how that's... I mean, Egypt, as James said, was an absolute powerhouse of African football. It won three African Cup of Nations in a row. Incredible stuff.
Juice, we hardly even touched on the fact that... hello, who's the Egyptian manager right now? Think about that for a second. Bob Bradley still, yes?
Yes, of course. Completely missed out on that one, Raph. I do apologize. Should have been, asking about Bobby B.
I was sitting here listening the whole time and just kind of like trying to take it all in, man. Like it's quite deep, the football in the Middle East. No?
Well, it's definitely one to have a re-listen to, and you can do that if you're a WFD premium member, and you can go back and listen to all of our previous shows and listen back to all the great guests that we've had, and definitely that is as one for a quick re-listen again to try and take in all of that information. James, very, very knowledgeable indeed, and a very interesting topic of how politics shapes the game and how the game also shapes politics as well. I mean, there's still the arguments going on about women's rights in the Middle East to play soccer. and how Middle Eastern soccer associations are starting to launch a campaign at the moment of to put women's soccer on a par with men's football in the region, and allowing women to kind of pursue athletic careers like their male counterparts. It's all, as I say, it's very interesting. There's so many years of history that go into it as well. And it's definitely something that if you're interested in that, we'll happily kind of get James back on the show again, or try and like send some links out to some of his stuff. And if you want, just email us, show at worldfootballdaily.com, at WFootballDaily on Twitter, or get on to us, 310-909-8483, 310-909-8483 down the phone line. And just let us know if you want to have a listen or a read of some of James's stuff. Very, very interesting indeed. We're going to take another quick break here on World Football Daily. We're going to have probably a little bit of extended music so we can take all of that in, work out where we are, and get ourselves back on the road and out of here. It's Tuesday's edition of World Football Daily. We'll be back mixing up just in a minute after a little bit of music from Mr. Gonzalez.